minus 60 and counting.
Step out of your vehicle, sir, the bored, authoritative voice was saying. License and registration, please.
A door opened and closed. The engine thrummed softly, holding the car an inch off the paving.
District manager for Raygon Chemicals?
Bradley going into a song and dance. Dear God, what if he didn't have the papers to back it up? What if there was no Raygon Chemicals? The back door opened, and someone began rummaging in the back seat. It sounded as if the cop, or was it the government guard that did this, Richards wondered half-coherently, was about to crawl right into the trunk with him. The door slammed. Feet walked around to the back of the car. Richards licked his lips and held the gun tighter. Visions of dead policemen gibbered before him, angelic faces on twisted, porcine bodies. He wondered if the cop would hose him with machine gun bullets when he opened the trunk and saw Richards lying here like a curled-up salamander. He wondered if Bradley would take off, try to run. He was going to piss himself. He hadn't done that since he was a kid, and his brother would tickle him until his bladder let go. Yes, all those muscles down there were loosening. He would put the bullet right at the juncture of the cop's nose and forehead, splattering brains and splintered skull fragments and startled streamers to the sky. Make a few more orphans. Yes. Good. Jesus loves me. This I know, for my bladder tells me so. Christ Jesus, what's he doing? Ripping the seat out?
Sheila, I love you so much, and how far will 6 grand take you?
A year? Maybe? If they don't kill you for it.
Then on the street again. Up and down, crossing the corner, swinging the hips, flirting with the empty pocketbook.
Hey, mister, I go down. This is clean kitty, kid. Teach you how.
A hand whacked the top of the trunk casually in passing.
Richards bit back a scream. Dust in his nostrils, throat tickling.
High school biology, sitting in the back row, scratching his initials and Sheila's on the ancient desk top.
The sneeze is a function of the involuntary muscles.
I'm going to sneeze my goddamn head off, but it's point blank, and I can still put that bullet right through his squash and... What's in the trunk, mister?
Bradley's voice, jocular, a little bored.
A spare cylinder that doesn't work half right. I got the key on my ring.
Wait, I'll get it.
If I wanted it, I'd ask.
Other back door opened. Closed.
Drive on.
Hang tight, fella. Hope you get him.
Drive on, mister. Move your ass.
The cylinders cranked up. The car lifted and accelerated. It slowed once and must have been waved on. Richards jolted a little as the car rose, sailed a little, and kicked into drive. His breath came in tired little moans. He didn't have to sneeze anymore. Minus 59, and counting.
The ride seemed much longer than an hour and a half, and they were stopped twice more. One of them seemed to be a routine license check. At the next one, a drawling cop with a dull-witted voice talked to Bradley for some time about how the goddamn commie bikers were helping out that guy Richards and probably the other one, too.
Laughlin had not killed anyone, but it was rumored that he had raped a woman in Topeka. After that, there was nothing but the monotonous whine of the wind and the scream of his own cramped and frozen muscles. Richards did not sleep, but his punished mind did finally push him into a dazed semi-consciousness. There was no carbon monoxide with the air cars. Thank God for that. Centuries after the last roadblock, the car kicked into a lower gear and banked up a spiraling exit ramp. Richards blinked sluggishly and wondered if he was going to throw up. For the first time in his life, he felt carsick. They went through a sickening series of loops and dives that Richards supposed was a traffic interchange. Another 5 minutes, and city sounds took over again. Richards tried repeatedly to shift his body into a new position, but it was impossible. He finally subsided, waiting numbly for it to be over. His right arm, which was curled under him, had gone to sleep an hour ago. Now it felt like a block of wood. He could touch it with the tip of his nose and feel only the pressure on his nose. They took a right, went straight for a little, then turned again.
The bottom dropped out of Richard's stomach as the car dipped down a sharp incline. The echoing of the cylinders told him that they were inside. They'd gotten to the garage. A little helpless sound of relief escaped him. "Got your check, buddy?" a voice asked. "Right here, pal. Rampway 5. Thanks." They bore right. The car went up, paused, turned right again, then left. They settled into idle, then the car dropped with a soft bump as the engine died. Journey's end. There was a pause, then the hollow sound of Bradley's door opening and closing. His footsteps clicked toward the trunk, then the chink of light in front of Richard's eyes disappeared as the key slid home.
"You there, Benny?"
"No," he croaked. "You left me back at the state line. Open this goddamn thing. Just a second. Place is empty right now. Your car's parked next to us, on the right. Can you get out quick?"
"I don't know."
"Try hard. Here we go." The trunk lid popped up, letting in dim garage light. Richards got up on one arm, got one leg over the edge, and could go no farther. His cramped body screamed. Bradley took one arm and hauled him out. His legs wanted to buckle. Bradley hooked him under the armpit and half led, half pushed him to the battered green went on the right. He propped open the driver's side door, shoved Richards in, and slammed it shut. A moment later, Bradley also slid in.
"Jesus," he said softly. "We got here, man. We got here."
"Yeah," Richards said.
"Back to go. Collect $200.
They smoked in the shadows, their cigarettes gleaming like eyes. For a little while, neither of them said anything. -58 and counting.
"We almost got it at that first roadblock,"
Bradley was saying as Richards tried to massage feeling back into his arm. It felt as if phantom nails had been pushed into it.
"That cop almost opened it. Almost."
He blew out smoke in a huge puff. Richard said nothing.
"How do you feel?"
Bradley asked presently.
"It's getting better. Take my wallet out for me. I can't make my arm work just right yet."
Bradley shooed the words away with one hand.
"Later. I want to tell you how Rich and I set it up."
Richards lit another cigarette from the stub of the first. A dozen Charlie horses were loosening, slowly.
"There's a hotel room reserved for you on Winthrop Street. The Winthrop House is the name of the place. Sounds fancy. It ain't. The name is Ogden Grasner. Can you remember that?"
"Yes.
I'll be recognized immediately."
Bradley reached into the back seat, got a box, and dropped it in Richard's lap. It was long, brown, tied with string. To Richards, it looked like the kind of box that rented graduation gowns come in. He looked at Bradley questioningly.
"Open it."
He did. There was a pair of thick blue-tinted glasses lying on top of a drift of black cloth. Richards put the glasses on the dashboard and took out the garment. It was a priest's robe. Beneath it, lying on the bottom of the box, was a rosary, a Bible, and a purple stole.
"A priest?"
Richards asked.
"Right. You change right here. I'll help you. There's a cane in the back seat. Your act ain't blind, but it's pretty close. Bump into things. You're in Manchester to attend a Council of Churches meeting on drug abuse. Got it?"
"Yes," Richards said. He hesitated, fingers on the bottoms of his shirt.
"Do I wear my pants under this rig?"
Bradley burst out laughing. -57 and counting. Bradley talked rapidly as he drove Richards across town. "There's a box of gummed mailing labels in your suitcase," he said. "That's in a trunk. The stickers say, after 5 days, return to Brick Hill Manufacturing Company, Manchester, New Hampshire. Rich and another guy ran them off. They got a press at the Stabbers headquarters on Boylston Street. Every day, you send your two tapes to me in a box with one of those stickers. I'll mail them to Games from Boston." Send me the stuff, speed delivery. That's one they'll never figure out.
The car cozied up to the curb in front of the Winthrop house.
This car will be back and you park it. Don't try to drive by Manchester unless you change your disguise. You got to be a chameleon, man.
How long do you think it will be safe here? Richards asked. He thought, I've put myself in his hands. It didn't seem that he could think rationally for himself anymore. He could smell mental exhaustion on himself like body odor.
Your reservation's for next week. That might be okay.
It might not.
Play it by ear. There's a name and an address in the suitcase. Fella in Portland, Maine? They'll hide you for a day or two. It'll cost, but they're safe.
I gotta go, man. It's a 5-minute zone.
Money time.
How much? Richards asked.
$600.
Bullshit. That doesn't even cover expenses.
Yes, it does. With a few bucks left over for the family.
Take $1,000.
You need your dough, pal.
Uh-huh. Richards looked at him helplessly. Christ, Bradley,
send us more if you make it.
Send us $1,000,000. Put us on easy street. Do you think I will?
Bradley smiled a soft, sad smile and said nothing.
Then why?
Richards asked flatly.
Why are you doing so much? I can understand you hiding me out. I'd do that. But you must have busted your club's arm.
They didn't mind. They know the score.
What score?
Ought to naught. That score.
If we don't stick out our necks for our own, they got us. No need to wait for the air. We could just as well run a pipe from the stove to the living room, turn on the freebie and wait.
Someone will kill you, Richard said.
Someone will stool on you and you'll end up on a basement floor with your guts beat out. Or Stacy. Or Ma.
Bradley's eyes flashed dimly. A bad day is coming, though. A bad day for the maggots with their guts full of roast beef. I see blood on the moon for them. Guns and torches. A mojo that walks and talks.
People have been seeing those things for 2,000 years.
The 5-minute buzzer went off, and Richards fumbled for the door handle. Thank you, he said.
I don't know how to say it any other way.
Go on, Bradley said, before I get a ticket.
A strong brown hand clutched the robe. And when they get you, take a few along.
Richards opened the rear door and popped the trunk to get the black satchel inside. Bradley handed him a quart of uncolored cane wordlessly. The car pulled out into traffic smoothly. Richards stood on the curb for a moment, watching him go. Watching him myopically, he hoped. The taillights flashed once at the corner, then the car swung out of sight, back to the parking lot where Bradley would leave it and pick up the other to go back to Boston. Richards had a weird sensation of relief and realized that he was feeling empathy for Bradley. How glad he must be to have me off his back, finally. Richards made himself miss the first step up to the Winthrop house's entrance, and the doorman assisted him. -56 and counting. 2 days passed. Richards played his part well, that is to say, as if his life depended on it. He took dinner at the hotel both nights in his room. He rose at 7, read his Bible in the lobby, and then went out to his meeting. The hotel staff treated him with easy, contemptuous cordiality, the kind reserved for half-blind, fumbling clerics who pay their bills in this day of limited legalized murder, germ warfare in Egypt and South America, and the notorious have-one-kill-one Nevada abortion law. The Pope was a muttering old man of 96, whose driveling edicts concerning such current events were reported as the closing humorous items on the 7 o'clock newsies. Richards held his one-man meetings in a rented library cubicle where, with the door locked, he was reading about pollution. There was very little information later than 2002, and what there was seemed to gel very badly with what had been written before. The government, as usual, was doing a tardy but efficient job of double-thinking. At noon, he made his way down to a luncheonette on the corner of a street not far from the hotel, bumping into people and excusing himself as he went. Some people told him it was quite all right, Father. Most simply cursed in an uninterested way and pushed him aside. He spent the afternoons in his room and ate dinner watching The Running Man. He had mailed 4 film clips while en route to the library during the mornings. The forwarding from Boston seemed to be going smoothly. The producers of the program had adopted a new tactic for killing Richard's pollution message. He persisted with it in a kind of grinning frenzy. He had to be getting through to the lip readers anyway. Now the crowd drowned out the voice with a rising storm of jeers, screams, obscenities, and vituperation. Their sound grew increasingly more frenzied, ugly to the point of dementia. In his long afternoons, Richards reflected that an unwilling change had come over him during his 5 days on the run. Bradley had done it. Bradley and the little girl. There was no longer just himself, a lone man fighting for his family, bound to be cut down. Now there were all of them out there, strangling on their own respiration, his family included. He had never been a social man. He'd shunned causes with contempt and disgust. They were for pigs, simple suckers, and people with too much time and money on their hands, like those half-assed college kids with their cute buttons and their neo-rock groups. Richard's father had slunk into the night when Richards was 5. Richards had been too young to remember him in anything but flashes. He'd never hated him for it. He understood well enough how a man with a choice between pride and responsibility will almost always choose pride, if responsibility robs him of his manhood. A man can't stick around and watch his wife earning supper on her back. If a man can't do any more than pimp for the woman he married, Richards judged, he might as well walk out of a high window. He'd spent the years between 5 and 16 hustling, he and his brother Todd. His mother had died of syphilis when he was 10 and Todd was 7. Todd had been killed 5 years later, when a newsy air truck had lost its emergency brake on a hill while Todd was loading it. The city had fed both mother and son into the municipal crematorium. The kids on the street called it either the ash factory or the creamery. They were bitter, but helpless, knowing that they themselves would most likely end up being belched out of the stacks and into the city's air. At 16, Richards was alone, working a full 8-hour shift as an engine wiper after school, and in spite of his back-breaking schedule, he'd felt a constant panic that came from knowing he was alone and unknown, drifting free. He awoke sometimes at 3 a.m. to the rotted cabbage smell of the one-room tenement flat, with terror lodged in the deepest chamber of his soul. He was his own man. And so he had married, and Sheila had spent the first year in proud silence while their friends, and Richard's enemies, he had made many by his refusal to go along on mass vandalizing expeditions and join a local gang, waited for the Uterus Express to arrive. When it didn't, interest flagged. They were left in that particular limbo that was reserved for newlyweds in Co-op City. Few friends and a circle of acquaintances that reached only as far as the stoop of their own building. Richards did not mind this. It suited him. He threw himself into his work wholly, with grinning intensity, getting overtime when he could. The wages were bad. There was no chance of advancement, and inflation was running wild. But they were in love. They remained in love, and why not? Richards was that kind of solitary man who can afford to expend gigantic charges of love, affection, and perhaps psychic domination on the woman of his choice. Up until that point, his emotions had been almost entirely untouched. In the 11 years of their marriage, they had never argued significantly. He quit his job in 2018 because the chances of ever having children decreased with every shift he spent behind the leaky GA old-style lead shield. He might have been all right if he answered the foreman's aggrieved, "Why are you quitting?" with a lie. But Richards had told him, simply and clearly, what he thought of General Atomics, concluding with an invitation to the foreman to take all his gamma shields and perform a reverse bowel movement with them. It ended in a short, savage scuffle. The foreman was brawny and looked tough, but Richards made him scream like a woman. The black ball began to roll. "He's dangerous. Steer clear. If you need a man bad, put him on for a week, then get rid of him." In GA parlance, Richards had shown red. During the next 5 years, he'd spent a lot of time rolling and loading newsies, but the work thinned to a trickle and then died. The freebie killed the printed word very effectively. Richards pounded the pavement. Richards was moved along. Richards worked intermittently for day labor outfits. The great movements of the decade passed by him ignored, like ghosts to an unbeliever. He knew nothing of the housewife massacre in 24 until his wife told him about it 3 weeks later. 200 police, armed with Tommy guns and high-powered move-alongs, had turned back an army of women marching on the Southwest Food Depository. 60 had been killed. He was vaguely aware that nerve gas was being used in the Mideast, but none of it affected him. Protest did not work. Violence did not work. The world was what it was, and Ben Richards moved through it like a thin scythe, asking for nothing, looking for work. He ferreted out 100 miserable day and half-day jobs. He worked cleaning jelly-like slime from under piers and in sump ditches when others on the street, who honestly believed they were looking for work, did nothing. Move along, maggot. Get lost. No job. Get out. Put on your boogie shoes. I'll blow your effing head off, daddy. Move. Then the jobs dried up. Impossible to find anything. A rich man in a silk singlet, drunk, accosted him on the street one evening as Richards shambled home after a fruitless day and told him he would give Richards 10 new dollars if Richards would pull down his pants so he could see if the street freaks really did have peckers a foot long. Richards knocked him down and ran. It was then, after 9 years of trying, that Sheila conceived. He was a wiper, the people in the building said. Can you believe he was a wiper for 6 years and knocked her up? It'll be a monster, the people in the building said. It'll have two heads and no eyes. Radiation, radiation, your children will be monsters. But instead, it was Kathy. Round, perfect, squalling. Delivered by a midwife from down the block who took 50 cents and 4 cans of beans. And now, for the first time since his brother had died, he was drifting again. Every pressure, even temporarily the pressure of the chase, had been removed. His mind and his anger turned toward the Games Federation, with their huge and potent communications linked to the whole world. Fat people with nose filters, spending their evenings with dollies and silk underpants. Let the guillotine fall, and fall, and fall. Yet there was no way to get them. They towered above all of them dimly, like the Games building itself. Yet, because he was who he was, and because he was alone and changing, he thought about it. He was unaware, alone in his room, that while he thought about it, he grinned a huge white wolf grin that in itself seemed powerful enough to buckle streets and melt buildings. The same grin he had worn on that almost forgotten day when he had knocked a rich man down and then fled with his pockets empty, and his mind burning. -55, and counting. Monday was exactly the same as Sunday. The working world took no one particular day off anymore, until 6:30. Father Ogden Grasner had meatloaf supreme sent up. The hotel's cuisine, which would have seemed execrable to a man who had been weaned on anything better than fast food hamburgers and concentrate pills, tasted great to Richards, with a bottle of Thunderbird wine, and settled down to watch The Running Man. The first segment, dealing with Richards himself, went much as it had on the two nights previous. The audio on his clips was drowned out by the studio audience. Bobby Thompson was urbane and virulent. A house-to-house search was taking place in Boston. Anyone found harboring the fugitive would be put to death. Richards smiled without humor as they faded to a network promo. It wasn't so bad. It was even funny, in a limited way. He could stand anything if they didn't broadcast the cops again. The second half of the program was markedly different. Thompson was smiling broadly. After the latest tapes sent to us by the monster that goes under the name of Ben Richards, I'm pleased to give you some good news. They had gotten Laughlin. He'd been spotted in Topeka on Friday, but an intensive search of the city on Saturday and Sunday had not turned him up. Richards had assumed that Laughlin had slipped through the cordon as he had himself, but this afternoon, Laughlin had been observed by two kids. He'd been cowering in a highway department road shed. He'd broken his right wrist at some point. The kids, Bobby and Mary Cowles, were shown grinning broadly into the camera. Bobby Cowles had a tooth missing. I wonder if the tooth fairy brought him a quarter, Richards thought sickly. Thompson announced proudly that Bobby and Mary, Topeka's number one citizens, would be on The Running Man tomorrow night to be presented certificates of merit, a lifetime supply of Funtwink cereal, and checks for $1,000 new each by his honor, the governor of Kansas. This brought wild cheers from the audience. Following were tapes of Laughlin's riddled, sagging body being carried out of the shed, which had been reduced to matchwood by concentrated fire. There were mingled cheers, boos, and hisses from the studio audience. Richards turned away, sickly, nauseated. Thin, invisible fingers seemed to press against his temples. From a distance, the words rolled on. The body was being displayed in the rotunda of the Kansas State House. Already long lines of citizens were filing past the body. An interviewed policeman, who had been in at the kill, said Laughlin hadn't put up much of a fight. Ah, how nice for you, Richards thought, remembering Laughlin, his sour voice, the straight-ahead, jeering look in his eyes. A friend of mine from the carpool. Now there was only one big show. The big show was Ben Richards. He didn't want any more of his meatloaf supreme. -54, and counting. He had a very bad dream that night, which was unusual. The old Ben Richards had never dreamed. What was even more peculiar was the fact that he did not exist as a character in the dream. He only watched, invisible. The room was vague, dimming off to blackness at the edges of vision. It seemed that water was dripping dankly. Richards had an impression of being deep underground. In the center of the room, Bradley was sitting in a straight wooden chair with leather straps over his arms and legs. His head had been shaved, like that of a penitent. Surrounding him were figures in black hoods. The hunters, Richards thought, with budding dread. Oh, dear God, these are the hunters. I ain't the man, Bradley said. Yes, you are, little brother, one of the hooded figures said gently, and pushed a pen through Bradley's cheek. Bradley screamed, "Are you the man? Suck it!" A pin slid easily into Bradley's eyeball and was withdrawn, dribbling colorless fluid. Bradley's eye took on a punched, flattened look. "Are you the man? Poke it up your ass!" An electric move-along touched Bradley's neck. He screamed again, and his hair stood on end. He looked like a comical caricature black. A futuristic step and fetch it. Are you the man, little brother?
Nose filters give you cancer, Bradley said. You're all rotted inside, honkies.
His other eyeball was pierced. Are you the man? Bradley, blind, laughed at them. One of the hooded figures gestured, and from the shadows, Bobby and Mary Cowles came tripping gaily. They began to skip around Bradley, singing, "Who's afraid of the big bad wolf? The big bad wolf? The big bad wolf?" Bradley began to scream and twist in the chair. He seemed to be trying to hold his hands up in a warding off gesture. The song grew louder and louder, more echoing. The children were changing. Their heads were elongating, growing dark with blood. Their mouths were open, and in the caves within, fangs twinkled like razor blades.
"I'll tell!" Bradley screamed. I'll tell, I ain't the man. Ben Richards is the man. I'll tell, God, oh, God.
Where is the man, little brother?
I'll tell, he's in.
But the words were drowned by the singing voices. They were lunging toward Bradley's straining, corded neck when Richards woke up, sweating. -53. And counting. It was no good in Manchester anymore. He didn't know if it was the news of Laughlin's brutal Midwestern end, or the dream, or only a premonition. But on Tuesday morning, He stayed in, not going to the library. It seemed to him that every minute he stayed in this place was an invitation to quick doom. Looking out the window, he saw a hunter with a black hood inside every old beaner and slumped taxi driver. Fantasies of gunmen creeping soundlessly up the hall toward his door tormented him. He felt a huge clock was ticking in his head. He passed the point of indecision shortly after 11 o'clock on Tuesday morning. It was impossible to stay. He knew they knew. He got his cane and tapped clumsily to the elevators and went down to the lobby.
"Gone out, Father Grasner?"
the day clerk asked with his usual pleasant, contemptuous smile. "A day off," Richard said, speaking at the day clerk's shoulder. "Is there a picture show in this town?" He knew there were at least 10, 8 of them showing 3D perverto shows.
"Well," the clerk said cautiously, "there's the center. I think they show Disney's."
"That will be fine," Richard said briskly, and bumped into a potted plant on his way out. 2 blocks from the hotel, he went into a drugstore and bought a huge roll of bandage and a pair of cheap aluminum crutches. The clerk put his purchases in a long, fiberboard box, and Richards caught a taxi on the next corner. The car was exactly where it had been, and if there was a stakeout at the U Park it, Richards could not spot it. He got in and started up. He had a bad moment when he realized he lacked a driver's license in any name that wasn't hot, and then dismissed it. He didn't think his new disguise would get him past close scrutiny anyway. If there were roadblocks, he would try to crash them. It would get him killed. But he's going to get killed anyway if they tabbed him. He tossed the Ogden Grasner glasses in the glove box and drove out, waving noncommittally at the boy on duty at the gate. The boy barely looked up from the Skin magazine he was reading. He stopped for a full compressed air charge on the high-speed urban sprawl on the northern outskirts of the city. The air jockey was in the midst of a volcanic eruption of acne and seemed pathetically anxious to avoid looking at Richards. So far, so good. He switched from 91 to Route 17, and from there to a blacktop road with no name or number. 3 miles farther along, he pulled onto a rutted dirt turnaround and killed the engine. Tilting the rearview mirror to the right angle, he wrapped the bandage around his skull as quickly as he could, holding the end and clipping it. A bird twittered restlessly in a tired-looking elm. Not too bad. If he got breathing time in Portland, he could add a neck brace. He put the crutches beside him on the seat and started the car. 40 minutes later, he was entering the traffic circle at Portsmouth. Headed up Route 95, he reached into his pocket and pulled out the crumpled piece of ruled paper that Bradley had left him. He had written on it, in the careful script of the self-educated, using a soft lead pencil, 94 State Street, Portland, The Blue Door, Guests, Elton Paracas and Virginia Paracas. Richards frowned at it a moment, then glanced up. A black and yellow police unit was cruising slowly above the traffic on the turnpike, in tandem with a heavy ground unit below. They bracketed him for a moment, and then they were gone, zigzagging across the 6 lanes in a graceful ballet. Routine traffic patrol. As the miles passed, a queasy, almost reluctant sense of relief formed in his chest. It made him feel like laughing and throwing up at the same time. -52 and counting. The drive to Portland was without incident, but by the time he reached the edge of the city, driving through the built-up suburbs of Scarborough, rich homes, rich streets, rich private schools surrounded by electrified fences, the sense of relief had begun to fade again. They could be anywhere. They could be all around him, or they could be nowhere. State Street was an area of blasted, ancient brownstones not far from an overgrown jungle-like park. A hangout, Richards thought, for this small city's muggers, lovers, hypes, and thieves. No one would venture out on State Street after dark without a police dog on a leash or a score of fellow gang members. Number 94 was a crumbling, soot-encrusted building with ancient green shades pulled down over its windows. To Richards, the house looked like a very old man who had died with cataracts on his eyes. He pulled to the curb and got out. The street was dotted with abandoned air cars, some of them rusted down to almost formless hulks. On the edge of the park, A Studebaker lay on its side like a dead dog. This was not police country, obviously. If you left your car unattended, it would gain a clot of leaning, spitting, slate-eyed boys in 15 minutes. In half an hour, some of the leaning boys would have produced crowbars and wrenches and screwdrivers. They would tap them, compare them, twirl them, have mock sword fights with them. They would hold them up into the air thoughtfully, as if testing the weather or receiving mysterious radio transmission through them. In an hour, the car would be a stripped carcass, from air caps and cylinders to the steering wheel itself. A small boy ran up to Richards as he was setting his crutches under himself. Puckered, shiny burn scars had turned one side of the boy's face into a hairless Frankenstein horror.
"Skag, mister? Good stuff. Put you on the moon."
He giggled secretly, the lumped and knobbed flesh of his burnt face bobbing and writhing grotesquely.
"Fuck off," Richard said briefly.
The boy tried to kick one of his crutches out from under him, and Richard swung one of them in a low arc, swatting the boy's bottom. He ran off, cursing. He made his way up the pitted stone steps slowly and looked at the door. It had once been blue, but now the paint had faded and peeled to a tired desert sky color. There'd once been a doorbell, but some vandal had taken care of that with a cold chisel. Richards knocked and waited. Nothing. He knocked again. It was late afternoon now, and cold was creeping slowly up the street. Faintly, from the park beyond the end of the block, came the bitter clacking of October branches losing their leaves. There was no one here. There was time to go. Yet he knocked again, curiously convinced that there was someone in there. And this time, he was rewarded with a slow shuffling of house slippers, a pause at the door. Then,
"Who's out there? I don't buy nothing. Go away."
"I was told to visit you," Richards said. A peephole swung open with a minute squeak, and a brown eye peeked through. Then the peephole closed with a snap.
"I don't know you."
Flat dismissal. "I was told to ask for Elton Paracas." Grudgingly.
"Oh, you're one of those..."
Behind the door, locks began to turn, bolts began to be unbolted, one by one. Chains dropped. There was the clock of revolving tumblers in one Yale lock, and then another. The chunk slap of the heavy-duty trap bolt being withdrawn. The door swung open, and Richards looked at a scrawny woman with no breasts and huge, knotted hands. Her face was unlined, almost cherubic, but it looked as if it had taken hundreds of invisible hooks and jabs and uppercuts in a no-holds-barred brawl with time itself. Perhaps time was winning, but she was not an easy bleeder. She was almost 6 feet tall, even in her flat, splayed slippers, and her knees were swollen into tree stumps with arthritis. Her hair was wrapped in a bath turban. Her brown eyes, staring at him from under a deep ledge of brow, the eyebrows themselves clung to the precipice like desperate mountain bushes, struggling against the aridity and the altitude, were intelligent and wild with what might have been fear or fury. Later he understood she was simply muddled, afraid, tottering on the edge of insanity.
"I'm Virginia Paracas,"
she said flatly.
"I'm Melton's mother. Come in."
-51 and counting. She did not recognize him until she had led him into the kitchen to brew tea. The house was old and crumbling and dark, furnished in a decor he recognized immediately from his own environment. Modern junk shop.
"Elton isn't here now,"
she said, brooding over the battered aluminum teapot on the gas ring. The light was stronger here, revealing the brown water stains that blotched the wall, the dead flies, souvenirs of summer past, on the window seals, the old aluminum creased with black lines, the pile of wet wrapping paper under the leaking drain pipe. There was an odor of disinfectant that made Richards think of last night in sick rooms. She crossed the room, and her swollen fingers made a painful search through the heaped junk on the countertop until they found two tea bags, one of them previously used. Richards got the used one. He was not surprised.
He works,
she said, faintly accentuating the first word and making the statement an accusation.
You're from that fellow in Boston, the one that LT writes to about pollution, ain't you?
Yes, Mrs. Paracas.
They met in Boston. My Elton services automatic vending machines.
She preened for a moment and then began her slow trek back across the dunes of linoleum to the stove.
I told Elty that what that Bradley was doing was against the law. I told him it would mean prison or even worse. He doesn't listen to me. Not to his old mom, he doesn't.
She smiled with dark sweetness at this calumny.
Elton was always building things, you know. He built a treehouse with four rooms out back when he was a boy. That was before they cut the elm down, you know. But it was that darky's idea that he should build a pollution station in Portland.
She popped the bags into cups and stood with her back to Richards, slowly warming her hands over the gas ring.
They write each other. I told him the mails aren't safe. You go to prison or even worse, I said. He said, but Mom, we do it in code. He asks for a dozen apples. I tell him my uncle's a little worse. I said, LT, do you think they can't figure that secret spy stuff out? He doesn't listen. Oh, he used to. I used to be his best friend. But things have changed. Since he got to puberty, things have changed. Dirty magazines under his bed and all that business. Now this darky. I suppose they caught you testing smogs or carcinogens or something, and now you're on the run. It don't matter,
she said fiercely at the window. It looked out on a backyard filled with rusting pieces of junk and tire rims and some little boy's sandbox that now, many years later, was filled with scruffy October woods.
It don't matter, she repeated. It's the darkies.
She turned to Richards, and her eyes were hooded and furious and bewildered.
I'm 65, but I was only a fresh young girl of 19 when it began to happen. It was 1979, and the darkies were everywhere. Everywhere! Yes, they were!
She nearly screamed, as if Richards had taken issue with her.
Everywhere! They sent those darkies to school with whites. They set them high in the government. Radicals, rabble-rousing, and rebellion. I ain't so...
She broke off as if the words had been splintered from her mouth. She stared at Richards, seeing him for the first time.
Oh, God have mercy,
she whispered. Mrs. Paracas?
Nope, she said in a fear-hoarsened voice. Nope, nope, oh, nope.
She began advancing on him, pausing at the counter to pick up a long, gleaming butcher knife out of the general clutter.
Out! Out! Out!
He got up and began to back away, slowly, first through the short hall between the kitchen and shadowy living room, then through the living room itself. He noticed that an ancient pay telephone hung on the wall from the days when this had been a bona fide inn. The blue door. Guests. When was that? Richards wondered. 20 years ago? 40? Before the darkies had gotten out of hand, or after? He was just beginning to back down the hall between the living room and the front door when a key rattled in the lock. They both froze, as if some celestial hand had stopped the film while deciding what to do next. The door opened, and Elton Paracas walked in. He was immensely fat, and his lackluster blonde hair was combed back in preposterous waves from his forehead to show a round, baby face that held an element of perpetual puzzlement. He was wearing the blue and gold uniform of the Vendo Spendo Company. He looked thoughtfully at Virginia Paracas. Put that knife down, Mom.
Nope!
She cried. But already, the crumbling of defeat had begun to putty her face. Paracas closed the door and began walking toward her. He jiggled. She shrank away.
You have to make him go, son. He's that bad man. That's Richards. It'll mean prison or worse. I don't want you to go.
She began to wail, dropped the knife, and collapsed into his arms. He enfolded her and began to rock her gently as she wept. I'm not going to jail, he said.
Come on, Mom.
Don't cry. Please don't cry. He smiled at Richards over one of her hunched and shaking shoulders, and embarrassed, awfully sorry about this smile. Richards waited.
Now, Paragus said, when the sobs had died to sniffles, Mr. Richards is Bradley Throckmorton's good friend, and he's going to be with us for a couple of days, Mom.
She began to shriek, and he clapped a hand over her mouth, wincing as he did so.
Yes, Mom. Yes, he is. I'm going to drive his car into the park and wire it, and you'll go out tomorrow morning with a package to mail to Cleveland.
Boston, Richard said automatically. The tapes go to Boston.
They go to Cleveland now, Elton Paragus said with a patient smile.
Bradley's on the run.
Oh, Jesus. You'll be on the run, too,
Mrs. Paragus howled at her son.
And they'll catch you, too. You're too fat.
I'm going to take Mr. Richards upstairs and show him his room, Mom.
Mr. Richards? Mr. Richards? Well, why don't you call him by his right name? Poison!
He disengaged her with great gentleness, and Richards followed him obediently up the shadowy staircase.
There are a great many rooms up here, he said, panting slightly as his huge buttocks flexed and clenched. This used to be a rooming house many years ago, when I was a baby. You'll be able to watch the street.
Maybe I better go, Richard said. If Bradley's blown, your mother may be right. This is your room, he said, and threw open a door on a dusty, damp room that held the weight of years. He did not seem to have heard Richard's comment.
It's not much of an accommodation, I'm afraid, but...
He turned to face Richards with his patient, I want to please smile.
You may stay as long as you want.
Bradley Throckmorton's the best friend I've ever had.
The smile faltered a bit.
The only friend I've ever had. I'll watch after my mom. Don't worry.
Richards only repeated, I better go.
You can't, you know. That head bandage didn't even fool Mom for long. I'm going to drive your car to a safe place, Mr. Richards. We'll talk later.
He left quickly, lumberingly. Richards noted that the seat of his uniform pants was shiny. He seemed to leave a faint odor of apologia in the room. Pulling the ancient green shade aside a little, Richards saw him emerge on the cracked front walk below and get into the car. Then he got out again. He hurried back toward the house, and Richards felt a stab of fear, ponderously climbing tread on the stairs. The door opened, and Elton smiled at Richards.
Mom's right, he said. I don't make a very good secret agent.
I forgot the keys. Richards gave them to him, and then essayed a joke. Half a secret agent is better than none. It struck a sour chord, or no chord at all. Elton Paragus carried his torments with him too clearly, and Richards could almost hear the phantom, jeering voices of the children that would follow him forever, like small tugs behind a big liner. Thank you, Richards said softly. Paragus left, and the little car that Richards had come from New Hampshire in was driven away toward the park. Richards pulled the dust cover from the bed and lay down slowly, breathing shallowly and looking at nothing but the ceiling. The bed seemed to clutch him in a perversely damp embrace, even through the coverlet and his clothes. An odor of mildew drifted through the channels of his nose like a senseless rhyme. Downstairs, Elton's mother was weeping.